It's great.
I always seem to be busy. I don't know. I keep thinking it's going to slack off, but it never does.
Listen, I thought I'd have nothing to do in retirement, and my days just fly by.
So. I am looking at retirement in the next year, so.
Okay. Do you have to take a graduated one, or do you mean
No, I'll probably do it. Well, I will be in fact graduated, because I have grants and stuff. So.
Okay.
But yeah. So it won't be a call to.
Thing. It's not an easy adjustment. I just hear Gary coming in. I'm just going to say hello. I'll be right back. Gary's been to the dentist. It's really cold here this morning.
Yeah, it's not that warm here either, but it's been like that for a few days. After our 37 degree weather last week, it's a bit.
I know, you don't know what to wear. Now, I won't be able to be part of the next session because I'll be on the train coming back from Montreal. Good morning, okay. Heather.
Morning.
Hi, Heather.
Hi.
I've been reading your stuff, Heather. I'm catching up.
Cool, yeah.
And I got Zendlin. I got an audio book of his focusing, but I think that's good.
Okay. Focusing is some of his earlier work. There are a few things that are representative of his evolution of thinking that I can point you to if you want.
Well, I had a look through that phenomenological paper. I didn't read it in detail, but I sort of skimmed through it.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good one for writers, I think, in particular. And then he has a process called thinking at the edge, which really reminds me a lot of this, of what Aaron Manning is doing. Mm. I'm excited. I have three practices for us to start with. Hope everyone's up for it.
Yeah, well, we're going to be a smaller group, I think. Cora's coming, but she's not. No, she's coming later, Cora. She's not going to be there for the first 20 minutes or so.
Okay.
And Hannah can't come.
Okay.
Marco, I think, said no. So it'll be a smaller group.
Okay. So we're waiting for Doug, maybe, and.
We're waiting for John, I guess. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the woman who's facilitating chapter 4 is coming, I presume, right?
Oh, Jocelyn. Yeah, indeed. We need her.
Yeah. I have horrible allergies today. Hay fever.
Well, I've lost my cold. I was listening to the episode last time, and I really had this cacking cough, but it's gone. So, and I didn't go to the doctor. So,
Well, I'm glad to hear you're better.
Is Doug? Hi, Doug. Hey, Doug. You're outside.
Morning, Doug. Yes.
Good morning. Or, is there a lot of background noise?
No.
Other than. No. Okay. Good. I'll mute myself just in case. Good to see everyone.
Does everyone have something to write with and to write on?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Yeah. Just wanted to make sure. I didn't know if Doug did when he's outside there.
I have some in my bag here.
Okay.
We'll wait a couple, maybe a minute or so more, but then we'll get started and people just have to come in and join us.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good.
So there's a saw running in the back, so I moved to the front of the house. So. Oh.
All sorts of everything going on here.
We're getting lots of background noises from everybody. It's like, John, when the sirens go in Manhattan, we all get to hear the police sirens go in Manhattan.
Yeah.
There's actually a house that exploded kind of unexpectedly. There's no gas heating or anything in there, so it's all over the news here in this small town, but so I assume that's what's going on right now. Oh. We don't have constant sirens going.
And you're in Colorado, right, Doug?
No, I'm in Kentucky.
Oh, I was thinking for some reason that you were. Okay, I'm wrong.
I live in Frankfurt, the capital, and then I'm working out of Georgetown, which is about 25 minutes east.
Okay.
So why don't we get started, and as I say, people will integrate people as they come in. If you can be flexible, I guess. Sounds like you've got something planned for us. So.
I do, yeah, absolutely. So in terms of people missing out, I have three gestures, which I'm thinking of. They're gestures, but they're also practices to start with. So if you're willing to go along with that sort of experiential, I'd like to have us look at the shifts described in the chapter a little more. And then I'll have a brief summary, and I thought we could then give individual responses. So okay. Everyone on board?
Yeah.
Okay. So I wanted to start with, so I've been reading this book lately as well. It looks backwards there. A New Writing Classroom, Listening, Motivation, and Habits of Mind. It's from the field of composition. I'm getting ready to think about my fall classes. And there's a quote here on well-structured and ill-structured problems. And the research is suggesting that ill-structured problems are the best ones for learning. So it says here, well-structured problems have single correct answers that are ultimately available. And the task for the problem solver is to find and apply a decision-making procedure to find, compute, or remember the solution. So that's the well-structured problem. Ill-structured problems cannot be resolved with a high degree of certainty, and experts often disagree about the best solution, even when the problem can be considered solved. They have a lot to offer students, these ill-structured problems, such as helping them develop a more complex epistemological framework and examine the evolution of knowledge itself. And it leads to more mature thinking, more reflection. So I just wanted to start with that because I'd like to invite us to consider these questions I'm going to ask and ask you to write briefly about as potentially ill-structured problems or ill-structured questions. They may not have an answer that's immediately apparent to you, and I want you to invite or welcome that sense of lack of fit or uncertainty, and let that be part of the process of answering. So the first question I'm thinking of as an orienting question, and that is, and so if you don't understand the question, rather than ask me to repeat it, I will repeat it twice, but rather than ask me to repeat it and explain it, I'd like you to feel into it. So here we're using your perception of the words in the question, and there is no wrong answer. So that's why I wanted to start with the idea of the ill-structured question. So the first question I'm thinking of it as an orienting question. I'll read it twice, and then I'll ask you to write about it for a minute and a half, and I'll let you know when we're getting close to that time. So what does weather refer to in the central metaphor of this chapter? If you could reach out and touch it, what would it feel like? So the chapter's title is Weather Patterns, or How Minor Gestures Entertain the Environment. So the question is, what does weather refer to in the central metaphor of this chapter? If you could reach out and touch it, what would it feel like? Go ahead and write about that for about a minute and a half. Hi, John. We're doing a quick writing exercise. I have three of them in a row to get started with. Can you hear me okay? Okay. If you have paper and pen, why don't you jump in with question two? Actually, I'll type it in the chat field.
Did you type it?
I'm typing it now. Okay, take another 15 to 20 seconds to wrap up, please. Okay. So ordinarily when I give a writing prompt, I give a time frame and it's more of a felt sense for me as I monitor it. I tend to bring the time to a close more as it feels ripe or ready. I'll ask you to look back through your response to question one and underline a word or a short phrase that captures the essence of what you understand weather to be in the chapter title. And I had added another question I didn't get a chance to type. I'm on my iPad, John. So the second part of it was, if you could reach out and touch it, what would it feel like? That was part two. So one of the problems with starting with this kind of a check-in where we have a short word or a phrase is there's a temptation to make this a jumping off point into our response to the chapter. I just want to say, I want to give time for that later. I'd just kind of like to hear what your words or phrases were first, if we could go quickly around, and then we'll move on to question two, which is an experiential question. Someone want to share their what they underlined from their response?
Mine is changing states of being.
Okay.
I have, it cannot be touched, it touches you. It cannot be seen for long, mostly felt.
Pat, you're on mute, I think.
Okay.
Yep.
I found this difficult because it was a surprise and an immediate answer didn't come to me. I read this chapter a couple of days ago and found it very difficult. But I guess I would say what came to my mind immediately about the metaphor is fogginess, cloudiness, coolness.
Perfect. Thank you. John, did you have time?
I just jotted down weather is an arrangement of moods and temperatures and constraints on what I can wear, what can be predicted, what can't.
I like that. Yeah, thank you. My response resonated a little bit with Doug's in the sense of from the chapter, I remember it's what we can sense on our skin. Also, there was that component to it. So the second gesture I'd like to start us off with, I'd like to have us experience the shift of the artful, where the threshold can be felt by which something becomes art or is activated as art. Aaron talks a lot in the chapter about time, multiplicity, and variability being part of this shift. If that means something to you, bring it in. Otherwise, we'll just set it off to the side. As we notice the shift in the experience, your feeling, when you look at a work of art, that moment when something becomes artful, and I'm gonna lead us in the reading of that, an introduction to the chapter, and then see if we can notice that shift. So pay attention to that as I read, and then I'll ask us just to jot down for a very short period of time some responses or reactions to that. So here's the opening to chapter 3, weather pattern. The movements of the sun on a terrace in the late afternoon. The smell of red in the fall. The weight of closed skies in a dark February winter. The moodiness of shadows on fresh snow. The light after the rain. She says on page 64, the smell of red is how the weather pattern of autumn makes itself felt. So I'd like to ask you to jot down any notes about a felt quality of the experience of those lines. How would you describe it? What is that felt quality? And again, this might be a struggle or difficult. That's okay. Invite that curiosity about that difficulty as you write.
Do you repeat the question, Heather?
Sure, I did that twice before, didn't I? Okay, so the question is, thinking about those initial lines of the chapter, notice the felt quality of that experience of those lines. What is it? What's the feeling of those lines? How would you describe it? So bring your thoughts to a close. I have one more ill-structured question, and then when we do our individual responses after I give a little summary, you might bring in, if you want, any of your responses to these questions. So this third question I'll ask you to write to for maybe just a minute and a half or 2 minutes is what I'm thinking of as a compass question. And the question is, what is the ecology of questions? So again, it's maybe a little difficult to feel into. What is the ecology of questions behind this chapter? In other words, what do you think moved Aaron to sit down and organize this exploration instead of something else, or this response and not something, some other response? So one more time, and welcome any curiosity about uncertainty. What is the ecology of questions behind this chapter? In other words, what do you think moved Aaron to sit down and write this exploration or response in particular instead of something else? Take another 30 seconds. Okay, if you've reached a stopping point, then look up.
So you want us to give our summaries?
Let me summarize just a few things from the chapter like you've done, Jeffrey, and then we'll take turns going around and responding however you want to, whatever spoke to you in the chapter or questions that you have. So what Jeffrey pointed out before was Erin has mentioned her work is meant to be read. So I thought I'd read just a few quotes, not a lot, and mention some of the patterns. As a friend pointed out to me, patterns and weather seem to be really central, at least in this chapter, but throughout the book as well. So we might be thinking about what those patterns are. The first quote I wrote down is, a minor gesture is a gesture that tweaks the experiential to make its qualitative operations felt, a gesture that opens experience to its limit. So this quote resonates across the sky of the chapter for me, because there's a sense of the limit, which we have as threshold throughout the chapter, and the quality or the experience comes up in it. And also the sense of more than. So it's pointing to something, what Erin calls more than, the more than human, that an artful work can activate or open. She mentions that it is a weather pattern when it emerges, activates a certain minor tendency that resonates across time. So I don't know, I've never thought of weather in terms of time before, but if you think of a weather radar map, there's usually a specific period of time that gets repeated in iterations and then advanced into the future. And the movement of the weather across the sky happens through time. She mentions ritual. She brings up Walter Benjamin's idea of the aura and says that this is stored in involuntary memory, the aura of the ritual work. And just to give a little context there, aura from Benjamin, the thinker, is something that differentiates an authentic work of art, right, from a mechanical reproduction of that work of art. He was writing about more Industrial Revolution reproduction, the idea that an artwork that's mechanically reproduced doesn't have that quality. Maybe that's what interests Erin in it, that quality, the aura, the livingness of the work. But she wants to recover the aura with technology. That's another question I think the chapter holds. We also have the idea of thresholds. Art is one way we cross a threshold. We move from multiple to multiplicity. We move from everyday into the ritual and back. And she says explanation reduces the force of the art. What I want to invite us to do is to question any of the assertions that they're not assertions the way I feel them. They're more gestures. They're more implyings, as Jenlyn would use the term, or they're formulations or expressions moving into becoming rather than an argumentative assertion. But I feel like we should feel invited to participate in them as well. And if we don't agree that explanation reduces the force of the art, we should feel free to bring a question to that. She says, when language becomes artful, words operate differently. Rather than denoting or pointing to the dictionary definition of the word, they make felt the beneathness of language in the crafting, like the smell of red. Let's see. Something that's artful in the gallery invents its own value or activates it. So this is that threshold moment again. When does something become art When does it become artful? She says, art comments creates a site of encounter that makes the cultural field tremulous. It creates a site of encounter in the cultural field, making it tremulous, that opens it to its minor gestures. So all becoming, as Deleuze and Guattari write, is minor or minatorian. All becoming is rife with the tension that comes with variation. A minor gesture is a living variation. To become artful, conditions are created to open an event to variability. I'm curious to know what others think later about how variability plays a role in art. That was a little harder to wrap my mind around, in multiplicity. To foreground the environment or the relational force between works is part of the task of the artwork. To call forth emergent ecologies that make operative imminent minor gestures. It's an emergent collective articulation. So this is this felt a little bit philosophical jargony to me. I don't know that we need to say that an art's task, artwork's task, is make operative the gestures and the emergent ecologies. We could also say that these emergent ecologies the artwork participates in, I don't know how to rephrase her. I just, one of my questions I'm holding is if some of this language is needlessly dense, or if the density is necessary. She says the minor gesture is the felt experience of potential, and also it's the threshold between the process and the object or the effect that is felt. How it touches the limit of the sensible is the field of maybe the weathered pattern. And almost done here. She points to more than human agency at work in art. She says, when a minor gesture opens the way for an experiential variation on the object, what emerges is artful. So again, variation on the object in this field of relating. Artfulness is the expression in a time of its own making of the processual force of what art can do. One more time, artfulness is the expression in a time of its own making of the processual force of what art can do. An object is already a field of relation. Okay, so those are all of the notes that I collected. I pointed to a couple of paragraphs that I won't read that felt really important, including the last one of the chapter. But rather than read it, I'll just kind of pull out some words here. Weather patterns are everywhere present. Some are artful, some not. And they make felt the intensity of material forces. It's not all human. We cross the event time of the threshold of the weather pattern. It's the more than human. And at its heart, it's ecological, multiple, and serial. Okay, so those are some of my opening thoughts, and I'd love to hear from each one of you what it was, either in the practices that spoke to you that we started with, or just from your memory of the chapter, what you found interesting. We want to take turns.
Who wants to go first? I've muted you all, so you'll have to unmute yourself to speak.
My background noise a bit too much right now. There's a mower kind of off and on, but that was quite a lot to take in. And I did go back to the intro and look at my notes. And one of the first notes I had was basically what you were saying at one point, Heather, when you were talking about the thresholds, I think, across through art. Like, is it even possible to make explicit or to explain this minor gesture? I feel like it's a major task in the first place to actually do what she's doing here. And so from the get-go, there's been a skeptical side of this Doug, wondering, like, is this even possible what she's doing? But then at the same time, throughout my reading, throughout the struggles, especially with last week's chapter, and Pat notes that this chapter was too was a little difficult to get through. And that's because she's trying to explain perhaps the unexplainable. But once you do work your way through it, at least for me, I have come through as changed. Even though I might not be able to be a meteorologist and describe all the details of the weather patterns or predict any future patterns, I can feel what she's getting at. Some of the notes that I took from your questions, the second question, or at least the second part of the ill-structured questions you had, I said it was, I don't even remember what the question was, but I circled the word koans, of the introduction of the chapter, the red of the, and just, it's basically a koan, so it's the stopping of the well-structured. And to do that, either it stops your thinking. It's almost a sort of reset for me. And it's when I am not, I'm going personal here, when I am not describing something, or when I am reaching out to the indescribable artfulness, or even going all the way to God or something like that, that cannot be described. Like, for me, that's her writing, and in the actual reading of it, I don't necessarily feel it. I'm not having epiphanies or anything like that, but the processing is going on there. There's quite a bit to say about what you said, so I'll stop there and see what others have to say.
Did you want to go, Pat?
Thank you, Dan. Yeah.
Well, I can say, I'd like to start by saying thank you to Heather for sort of condensing this dense chapter into what you saw as major ideas. I'm having trouble with what I feel is dissonance between the sensorium or feeling and the brain and thinking about what this chapter intends. I loved the writing, and I tend to get sidetracked to think about the meaning of the meaning below the words when she's talking about beneath the words. So what I thought about a lot as I read this chapter was my husband got that phone, sorry, was the Infinity Mirrors, the Kasuma exhibition that has just left the art gallery of Ontario. It was an incredible experience, both cognitively, socially, and phenomenologically for both me and my husband. And what this chapter resonated, how this chapter resonated with that experience was the role of the spectator, the artist, and the piece of art. You know, and that idea of eliciting a minor gesture. I just found the whole thing really intriguing. So, and Kusama, I don't know if you all know about this exhibition, but it's well worth looking at the AGO website. It's absolutely amazing. The artist is in her late 80s, and she uses technology in an incredible way with mirrors and lights, and the spectators are always part of the emerging art that is seen and discussed in the gallery.
Awesome. Can you share a link to that in our forum?
I don't know. It's the art. I'll send it to Jeffrey.
Okay, great.
Art Gallery of Ontario, and that
it has
the most. The Art Gallery of Ontario has had the most visitors for this than any other exhibit in history. Just could never get a ticket to see it. We were very lucky to get in. And again, it was all cultures, all just like Toronto is, a very diverse city, social class, ages, just an amazing experience where the whole gallery was throbbing. Anyway, I hope I haven't taken us off topic, but that's where the chapter should be.
Yeah, thank you.
Maybe I'll segue in there because one of my comments, because one of the things I had thought about while reading the chapter was Pat's comment last time about the exhibit that she saw. I can't remember where it was, but...
In London.
In London, yes, yeah. So there is a sense of resonance between, I mean, first of all, because the chapter describes an exhibit in a way. And so there is, but there's lots of resonance between art in exhibits or art in that context and what she's talking about throughout the book in a way. So I thought that was an interesting reflection. I also really liked your exercises, Heather, at the beginning of this. So, I mean, I read it as I tend to read, very intellectually. And your exercises took me, so when you asked about the feeling of those lines, then what I got came up through was more a body response, because you know you're talking about feeling, and your compass question about what is the ecology of questions behind the chapter took me into thinking about how the individual experience fits within the larger experience, which is certainly part of what Aaron is dealing with the minor gesture. It's not the minor gesture isn't just a gesture that you do on your own. It's a gesture that you do in relation to a larger group of people. And so that was also, for me, I mean, it was there in my reading, but it wasn't foregrounded the way that your question brought it foreground for me. I also had a series of, most of my comments, because I like the others. I found the chapter, even though the chapter in some ways is more tangible than the earlier ones, it deals with a real exhibit. And she starts the chapter, she says, I think here of the many hours in my own art practice spent making objects that resemble one another. The 2,000 pieces of fabric, for instance, from my work Folds to Infinity, which took me 7 years to sew. And I wonder to what extent it is less the object that matters than the ritualized gestures that compose it hour after hour, year after year. So that was right in the early paragraphs of the chapter. And I thought, oh, we're going to get something much more tangible. But then the chapter somehow becomes less tangible. And it's not an easy chapter to understand. It slides around through different concepts, many of which are new, although they're interesting, and so I found it not an easy read, despite the sort of, but I did like this focus on ritual. So ritual is an aspect of the world that really interests me. So she says, so what I've done is I have a series of readings, and then I have my reactions to the readings. And then I have her reactions that might answer some of my reactions. So it's kind of a dialogue between her readings and my thoughts. So her writing was, rituality is the return through repetition to a task that, despite its habitual nature, is nonetheless capable of shifting the field of experience. the morning coffee that opens the way for the day to beginning, the cleaning of the desk that creates the conditions for a day of writing, the breathing techniques for the performer that facilitate the shift from the street to the theater. That was her writing. And then I wrote, as I am reading this, a Saturday morning, I'm struggling with the same issues, how to open up my writing practice for the day. And I have done so by preparing a hot breakfast with bacon, albeit a minor variant involving a bagel and tomato, but no eggs or onion. Repeated ritual also has this property of foregrounding the singular. Each repetition is different from all the others if one is attentive. And it is these differences that prepare the way for a shift in the field. So that's me writing. And then Aaron writes, despite their adherence to the inheritance of the past, rituals are ever changing, altered by the conditions of futurities in the making. It is in these futurities in the making, as mobilized by the face of form of the object, that can continue to be felt in the object's passage back to the everyday. So she seems to be, she echoes my writing after I wrote it. I mean, she wrote it before, but obviously in the text as we're going down through the text. So I really like this idea of rituality in both its repetition, but also in its variance and its difference from one time to the next. And I felt that that was present in this idea of weather as well. I'll come back to that in a moment. She says, hang on, I'll get to it in a moment. How come did I do that? Okay. Maybe I have to just go straight through this and then, so despite, oh no, I read that. If the art is one way that the crossing of the threshold occurs, how does the passage from the multiple to multiplicity occur? So I thought that was an interesting question. And I thought my reaction was, okay, I've got my 15 books, which is my saga that I'm writing. How do the 15 books take me from multiple to multiplicity as an artistic activity? So, and then she writes, it is important not to deny the disabling. She says, a ritual object is always singular or multiple in the sense that even it is used alone, it carries the force of the differential of all past rituals and all future rituals. The ritual object is less a form than a material force. Well, I thought that was a kind of response to my question in a way. It certainly gives me a way into thinking about an answer to it. You talked about learning when we started, Heather, and I had a whole series of things about that. So Aaron says, for the object to become artful, conditions must be created that open the event to a variability. I think you actually read that. What matters is not what the object represents, but what it can do. To foreground what an object can do involves activating its ecology of practices, opening it to its differential. To do so, it is imperative, it seems to me, to include, to make participatory, the ecology of which it is a part. That's Aaron. And then my reaction was, I thought, think of a university and its teaching practices this way. Learning is in the realm of the minor, or variation and singularity, but our universities attempt to reorganize it within the major. This doesn't work, or at least not well, but the discourse denies there's any failure at all. So, and then Aaron writes, this ecology is as much at the heart of the object itself as in its seriality. Too often the art exhibition holds the object to itself as though it were internally bound. In a similar gesture, it foregrounds individual work instead of activating the environment or foregrounding the relational force between works. And then my reaction to that is the university isolates the lesson taught as an individual learning rather than a learning where the larger and smaller ecologies interpenetrate and become entangled. So we are taught by getting rid of everything and just focusing on the content in front of us. But the content in front of us is never situated as a knowledge on its own. It's always situated in regard to everything else going on. And again, I felt that. So I felt that a lot of what she was saying was relevant to the context of, even though she's talking about exhibits, I thought it was relevant to the context of learning, you know, in university, because that's where I teach, but in that kind of a context. So I don't have any global summaries. I have bits and pieces like that that I pulled out of the chapter because I found it hard to come up with a global summary of the chapter, even though I think in a way your exercises, Heather, helped me do that more than the actual reading of the chapter did.
Great, thank you, Jeffrey. I have a response too, but John, do you have a response to the chapter? You're on mute too.
Yes, yeah, sure. I came late to this chapter. I only started reading it this morning. So I didn't have time to prepare or over-prepare as I often do. I feel like someone with narcolepsy, you know, there are people who have, they fall asleep for about 3 or 4 seconds and then they're awake again. So I remember listening to a narcoleptic talk about her experience at a dinner table, for instance. And she would, you know, for a few seconds, she'd go to sleep. And then all of a sudden, so she would miss something that happened in the conversations around her, but she got very intuitive about sort of filling in the gaps. So that's what I feel this morning. As I review the what I read and what I skimmed, a lot was triggered because my mother was a seamstress. She was also a designer. She designed children's clothes. And a lot of it was handmade. And for individuals who would, you know, ask her to do something, to create a dress for their child. And these were children's clothes. She did do some designs for older people, but she, but I was fascinated because she got me involved in it because a lot of it was handmade and applique, and she also did some textile painting. And she always gave me the job to do the textile painting. Because I had a background in art and I studied art quite a bit in my early teens with a painter, who's a very accomplished painter. And so I learned how to stretch a canvas, put gesso on it. I learned about watercolors and pastel and oil. I learned how to clean brushes. I remember this old French lady with the artist I studied with, she would how to clean a brush. You know, after you washed it, you would put the brush into your mouth and wet it with saliva. And sometimes I didn't always wash it really well because I could still feel a little bit of linseed oil and turpentine in my mouth. So tasting red, you can smell red, you can also taste red. So those are the kind of associations that emerged as I was reading the chapter. It's very visceral. Also, my mother came to New York and she designed the costumes for a show that I did. I was co-producing a production of The Apple Cart, George Bernard Shaw. And it was a hard show to put together because it was a very formal kind of dress and it was a very much a period piece. So I was in a panic. So I called my mother and she came up to New York and she did the clothes and she designed everything. And it was magnificent. I mean, she really made the show happen. it was a beautiful experience that we also had those exchanges, which is odd because I realized there was something very transgressive about a mother and son having this kind of artistic collaborative, and she initiated it. I mean, I got into art because of her, because she paid attention when I was drawing and painting, and she went, yes, do that. She was very much a stage mother as well. Certain things that she didn't have, she chose me, actually, to, she wanted to cultivate those hidden aspects of her own nature, unexpressed, because she was quite an inhibited Southern lady, and she wasn't allowed to go to art school, even though she won a scholarship, because her father said, you know, girls don't need to go to college. You know, she came from that kind of very hard patriarchal dominance. So her artistic aspirations, she wasn't able to express till much later in her life. But anyway, that's what's coming up for me, is just listening to her as we all went to bed. Also, this is how our family survived, was through her artistry. She was able to just open a shop, you know, porcelains, tapestries. It was an odd kind of shop, and her clothes. She was able to support our family, which my father could not do. He was worthless in terms of supporting the family. He was a total mess. But my mother was able to pull all that off. It's quite amazing. So that's what's coming to me. As we all went to bed at night, I heard a sewing machine way past midnight. My mama at that sewing machine, and she was relentless. So I think that's what sort of, she just had all these designs and she just had to put it together and make it happen. And then she would sell it and make money and pay the rent. But I'm just looking at what motivated, that question you asked about what motivated Aaron to sit down and write. It's probably the thing, same thing that made her sit down and sell. And the same reason, and I was just thinking what motivated me, for instance, instead of reading a chapter that I wanted to prepare for today, instead I went out and I did the ritual of like going out. And I didn't want to meet anybody, that's for sure. And I was very happy at home, but I felt like I needed something else and I don't know what it was until I got out and I just saw, I like sitting and observing and watching. It was a gay bar, a working class bar. I was watching two black men as they were listening to a Motown hit, how they gestured and moved, and they pointed to each other and they burst out laughing. And there was something underneath the music and the movement, a fourth dimension, if you will, that they were plugged into. And that sort of social imagination is what I, on occasion, really need. And so I found myself just enjoying that I was a participator. There's something about a gay bar too, which is sort of an endangered species these days. I'm noticing that culture, that invisible thing that you can't put a finger on, But I see gay men, they have especially that night as I was observing, there was a heightened masculinity mixed in with a female force. And I was wondering, as this was in my notes and I'm jotting it down, why do I say female? And I realized it's like a cat in heat in a back alley howling. It's not feminine, it's female. And I think that's something that I think gay men, we're not individuals. I think a gay bar is not, it's trans individual. It's much more about, it's not about any particular individual. It's about what happens when, what happens in the in-between as these individuals walk into the gay bar, moving out of a straight world into a gay world. How do they drop? Those inhibitions that they had to, that were imposed on their bodies so that they could function in a straight world. but then they're not there anymore. Something else can come on. Something else can happen that was there all along, but can get amplified. And I find that amplification extremely borderline rapture for me. I mean, it's ecstasy. But which can too easily get confused with sex, because it's not really about sex at all. It was when I was much younger, but now it's much more about something much more aesthetic, I think, a little more abstract. Anyway, thank you for giving me this opportunity to share this. I haven't, but I think this is triggered by the exercise that we did, that you led us through, Heather, and my sort of skimming of these two chapters. So now I'm going to really enjoy going back and reading them with more care, because I think a lot of more associations will probably emerge, but associations with the direction. And that's what I like about her work. It isn't just free association. I sense that she does have a direction that keeps me going, because I think she has a very compelling, there's a drive. Something's compelling her to sit down and do this. Thanks.
Thank you. Wow, that's awesome. We have Jeffrey, who mentioned reading it intellectually, but responded in the margins. And then we have John, who shares the highly experiential version of the chapter. I felt like some of your shares were attuned with this larger relational field. I also had experiences with narcolepsy. And
you have?
Well, I had several days where I was dropping out inexplicably. I had allergies really bad the last few days, and I would just get so tired, and I thought a few times, I wonder if this is what narcolepsy feels like. Yeah, I think you were with the chapter just as much as any of us, it sounds like, and maybe even preparing the way for it, which I find can be really important with this kind of field sharing experience, the bodily preparing, or the, you know, resonance preparation, that sort of thing. But I just want to share a few quick thoughts since I took a long time on the summary. I found myself wanting to make a Wordle, if you know that art form. It's not really an art form, it's a web software that you can put a bunch of words in and it creates kind of a word map. I thought I might do that with some of the words from this chapter and post it after as an image. So it would, I feel a desire to see her patterns exemplified thematically in a kind of non-organized, like non-linear sort of map, just kind of emerging out of like beads of water kind of coming through the surface. I loved how John said writing and sewing, and he made a connection there. And what one of the things I wrote on the cover as I was reading chapter 3, I made a note of incipient, which I want to come back to. Incipient really being, I think, an important part of her work. She has incipient movement, which is really feeling the genesis of the movement, the beginning of it. And since so much of the emphasis here is on the becoming, artwork as a becoming, an activation, a material force or a field of force, or a field of relation, that shifts the art from object to something with a beginning that continues to unfold, maybe across time. So I really wanna come back to that term again and again and understand it better. And then I also wrote, how are these examples metaphors or lenses for writing? So these different art forms. I took a film poetics class, and the teacher would have us sometimes do a writing about, what did you pick up on the artistry of this film that we just saw? And how can you translate that into your writing? Kind of like create a prompt for yourself that enacts that visual metaphor. So if it was an experimental film with a lot of collage, how might you import that collage into your writing? Or if we watched a documentary that obscured the observer's focus and made that more diffuse, how might you bring that into your writing? And so I just really was thinking about these vectors and folds, and the, in particular, that applied more to chapter 4 for me, but I think weather also has a lot to offer. I found myself wanting to question her premises in chapter 3. Must art include movement, activation, perceptible shifts, and the more than human agency? So she's talking about an evolution of art for me. So when she calls that the artful and says it's the way of art, she's creating something new, and I don't know that that's explained, and it doesn't have to be according to her own argument, because that might be part of the artfulness of this book. But there are plenty of examples in history of art objects that have an aura that might be part of that relational field of its ritual creation or its reception. But her art in particular frustrates me a little bit, because like with the example, the second example, I wrote down the title, but I have a hard time remembering it for some reason. The one that begins with a V. Very quickly, I think I can probably turn to it. Volumetrics. So the cloth that was black and the people didn't respond to it, even when it was in the ecology with the other work in the weather series. So she's got these earth magnets in it. She goes into, you know, she's put a lot of care into creating an interactional piece, a piece that people will experience. And I think that's a new understanding of art as process that is very important for her. And it's a premise. It's even maybe an implicit premise. I think she's aware of it, but I guess I want to continue to ask the question alongside her, because she wants that volumetrics to become artful. She wants it to find its place. And I also want to accept the possibility that it won't. I'm sure she's grappled with that, but she almost seems to be ruling out the failure of the artwork in the way she wants it to carry forward these gestures and to find its ability to activate her work. So I found that interesting. Maybe that's something she's pointing to or feeling behind the artwork. Thought that might be interesting. And then I went back to her quote from the last call that I liked. Art is before all else a quality, a difference in kind, an operative process that maps the way toward a certain attunement of world and expression. And I just, you know, kind of want to ponder that. I also want to offer open focus reading. I find myself doing that more with her. It's a practice I learned a few years ago where you notice what you resonate with most strongly and sort of map that with a very diffuse, rather than the highly critical, highly intellectual, I'm going to figure this out, I'm going to dive in, I'm going to parse it all. So I thought I might share in the forum an audio that helps with the open focus awareness in case anyone else wants to try that. There's Cora. Okay, that's all I had for my check-in. So welcome, Cora.
Hi, I'm so sorry I'm late today. I have a long meeting, rogue meeting gone too long. Sorry, I don't want to interrupt. Carry on.
No worries. We just finished with chapter 3, I think. That was all I really had planned. So if anyone else
wants
to. I
agree, I think we'll. But Jocelyn's not around, so we're going to have to wing chapter 4. Mm-hmm. I did one, there was one, I guess maybe it's not that important, but I had one comment that I forgot to mention about weather in relation to chapter 3. So I did have this idea that when we talk, because when I was reading it, I was in the street and I said hello to somebody and we talked about the weather. And of course, when you meet somebody, that's what you do. I mean, somebody you know, somebody you don't know, you talk about the weather. And so I was sort of intrigued by what's involved there and the fact that talking about the weather opens up a conversation which is otherwise difficult to engage in. And so I felt in some ways that is also a kind of reflection of what Aaron is talking about in that chapter. So for chapter 4, so it's dressed.
Do you mind if I stop you? I wanted to kind of respond to you, which kind of ties in with what John said.
We don't have to rush.
So I did have a question for John, which what you just said, it also ties in with Heather's kind of questioning the volumetrics. How do we explain, she wants to explain this to other people and it's not possible at this time. So she seems like she's continuing that. And then what John shared about just that sense of knowing the underlying fourth dimension, as you called it. You almost said at one point, like, it just cannot, you cannot share this with anyone else, or you can't share this with the gay community or somebody at the gay bar, just like you're talking about the weather. It's beyond the weather in a certain sense. And but then you said you can, like, thanks for listening, like, this is about the only place I can share ideas like this. At least I assume that's kind of where you're getting at. And so I'm wondering, like, which it doesn't have to be answered here, but that's kind of where I'm leaving off, is where, like, what is that indescribable thing, and why can we not share it? Maybe that's where I left off on, or where I'm at in my own life. I've been exploring that for a couple of years. How do we go beyond talking about the weather, even just as you meet somebody? Why can we not just simply go beyond that? Yeah, why can it not be shared? But that's a question that doesn't have to be answered. So
I can respond to that, if I may. This is not original with me. I heard this somewhere, but I think it's accurate. When people are talking about the weather, they're not really talking about the weather. They're talking about something else, or they're responding. I think what's happening when we initiate conversations with other people, we talk about the weather. Well, it's something that we all have in common. It's often background, but when we're initiating conversations with strangers or even people we know, it's a way of testing the affective landscape. And based upon the response this person is having to the weather, I will open up, or I might deflect or shut down. Because if they're loving this weather and I'm hating this weather, or vice versa, we're going to know a lot about one another, you know. And sometimes rainy days I love, sometimes a rainy day is the last thing I want. And sometimes, you know, any kind of weather can become problematic or boring. Even beautiful weather, like they have out in California, can become extremely dull after a while. I remember when I was in LA, there was this thunderstorm. I was visiting friends there, and there was a big thunderstorm. And everyone was like running to their cars or getting under a canopy or hiding out in a cafe. And there was a thunder clap, you know, and torrential rains. And then it all cleared and the sun came out. And I went, wow, everyone really got excited about that. And my friend said, that's because it never rains here. You know, like, LA is like a desert. And no, there is no rain in LA. So when a thunderstorm happens like that, it's a very dramatic occasion. So I'm just bringing that up because I think I think there is something else going on when we talk about the weather that's very important. So I think it helps both persons stabilize something that it's a shared space. But then they can go on to more complex information if they want to. Because if you can't get the weather right, chances are we're not going to go very far in this relationship. So, and also about, it isn't that I can't explore experiences about gay culture within gay culture, but it's not within in a gay bar while that's happening. And think millions of micro dynamic and macro dynamic dimensions are coming at me. It's not a gay bar is not a verbal place. It's big. I could go to a workshop, or I could go to a university campus where they're exploring gay studies, you know, and people are reading Deleuze. You can find lots of people who can put into words their experience as a gay person, or their experience about how they feel about gay culture. Even though they're not a member of that culture, they can have they can resonate with or have dissonance about that culture. So I think there are meaning-making spaces where we can explore this, as well as in gay literature and gay art and music. It's hugely influenced by, so there's gay presences everywhere in our art worlds, which I think everyone's responding to, subliminally perhaps. So I think it's just that it's just not something you can interrupt in a gay bar and start making meta comments about gay culture while it's happening. So that's my response, Doug, to your response. So thank you for this opportunity.
Your response. I appreciate that.
It's quite
sounds like I just need to wave my magic wand to get past the weather comments. So I'll work on my personality or something. But anyways.
Doing great. Thank you.
You'll have to get me to talk at some point, John, about my experiences in gay bars years ago, because I used to go to them not because I was gay, but because I could dance any way I wanted to.
I used that to remind-
a long time in gay bars because I liked to dance and I didn't like the standard ways. So
it may be that female force that's allowed in a gay setting, you know.
Exactly.
And I think a lot of straight guys get really inhibited about wiggling their hips, you know. Their gay brothers may have assisted them in loosening up a little bit over the decades. But I remember when my brother came visited me, who's straight, and we were in my apartment, and I was hosting him. But after about a week of, you know, going to all the tourist sites and things like that, I said, "Well, you know what? I think I'm going to go out tonight." And he said, "Oh, okay. I'll come too." And I went, "Well, you know, I really want to go to a gay bar." And he said to me, "You think I've never been to a gay bar before?" I said, "Oh, okay, you can come." So I took him out to a gay bar and introduced him to acquaintances and friends, and they all thought he was my boyfriend. I went, no, he's not my boyfriend. He's my brother. Your brother? You brought your brother to a gay bar? And it's so, but I realized that, you know, that overlap between identifications and culture and how we hold ourselves in certain environments or how we inhibit ourselves in certain environments, I think that gets imprinted in our bodies and in our minds. So it's great that we have other venues where we can go to and let some of that go, you know, and see what happens.
I was just going to add that a friend of mine who lives in New Orleans finds that ability to express that energy and dance however he wants and dress however he wants with the Mardi Gras and the general culture of masquerade and parties. And so he uses that as a practice, and he'll often send me pictures of the elaborate costumes at somewhere he's at, or I can definitely see how that works for him.
Yeah, it's carnival culture.
Yeah.
I used to wear a skirt there. It was the only place I ever wore a skirt.
I'm sure you look stunning, Jeffrey.
I think we do need to move on because I mean the schedule calls the two chapters in the one time. We can maybe at some if it's too difficult to do two in one go, and also the reading is quite demanding to read two as well. We may choose to slow things down a little bit, but it would lengthen the series slightly to do that. But I leave it open as an option if people feel that it's a lot to do in the time that we have and would like to stretch it out a bit more. So Jocelyn's not here, so I will. I don't have a real summary for the next chapter. I do think maybe it's slightly easier read than this one. Although I don't really have a summary of it, the sort of first, I mean, I am a fashion designer myself, so I can resonate with Aaron, and Aaron is a fashion designer, and so I sort of resonate with Aaron and with the people that she's talking, you know, the designers that she's talking about. So for instance, at one point, she starts off with maybe it's not the first one, but the Comme les Garçons, the collection. And Doug, I think you posted, was it you, Doug, who posted
the collection? Marco, I believe.
Colored versions, colored photos of the collection, which I looked at really quickly before this session today. And it really gives a sense of the unusual nature of the clothes that what's her name, Kawakubo, was constructing. So and I mean, it's, you know, I have a strong aesthetic about clothes. And so I must admit, when I first looked at these things, I thought, whoa, I'm not sure I like this, you know? And then as I got into it a bit more and understanding how these things come into being, and of course they have a relationship to questions like disability, that she is explicitly present in some ways in some of these formulations or constructions. And so I actually found that more and more intriguing as I got into it. And so I think that's part of what she's talking about, the fact that there is a kind of a dissonance with regard to these clothes. But there's also a way that I found that the clothes and the way she talks about them inhabit you, because it's hard to read this chapter without putting your body into it, because it's talking about the body and clothes. And so we imagine ourselves wearing these clothes when we read the chapter, and we sort of put our body into it, as it were. I didn't really have a lot to say about that part of the chapter, except that it, how it resonated with me reading it and thinking about these clothes. But in the second part of the chapter, at some point she gets to this, so she talks about modes, more tech terminology, Pat, so modes of existence and procedural architecting. And so, I mean, they're interesting terms, although they're a bit difficult to get your head around what they're talking about. But I did like this idea of, Erin says, modes of existence come into being through enabling constraints. Constrained in the sense that it occurs according to the limits of this or that singular junction. Each time a mode of existence comes into being, it does so just this way. For Rei Kawakubo, her practice involves continuously experimenting with constraints she sets in place. So when I design, I'm also aware of the constraints, both the body's constraints and the constraints of the design that one is working with. So I was thinking about, what does she mean by constraints? And so I'm thinking she's talking about movement and shape and form, but she's also talking about identity. So there are constraints on identity that are also implicit in some of this work. And degrees of freedom, which to me is somewhat different from movement itself. It's the possibility of movement that the garment permits or restricts that I also found interesting. And I often think about those things when I am working on designs. And then she says, modes of existence as they are crafted out of ecologies of practices are never primarily human. So it comes back to this non-human aspect of ecology and practice. And then in the last part, she talks about Derrida's definition of the term, takes it much further. For Derrida, the term is deconstruction. For Derrida, the deconstruction is never a method, but rather a way to return again to the act of reading or making in order to see how it stages the alliances to form, to history, to epistemology. In the context of the choreographic, in its relation to dance, it is always compelling, I find, to explore the share of movement that remains, that is left over in the passage from force to form. This is particularly perceptible in the work of choreographer William Forsythe. In rehearsal, Forsythe repeatedly encourages his dancers to leave behind the form of the movement in order to explore what exceeds its form, its representational stature. Now, Cora has a lot on this because it came into her thesis in some important ways. And I think you have some sites you could possibly share with the group about Forsythe's work, which shows how his choreographic practice leads to these traces that are left behind that I think are very important. What is that? Erin writes, what is at stake here is not simply the making apparent of the seams of the garment's production, but a foregrounding of the imminent potentiality in the seams, at the edges, in the linings of the garment. So again, and she says, I think she says, among my favorite pieces of Comme les Garçons are these early works, not simply because they shed and fade and show their fragility, but because they open the act of dressing to the fragile articulations of fashion's very composition, allowing the garment to function as a lively interstice. That the garments feel alive is key to their artfulness. And so those, and she shows the image of the garments with the seams highlighted in contrast, white against a black background of the garment, or the garment which has one sleeve which is transparent and the rest which is black, which is another way of highlighting those differences. And in my own designs, I could probably put something up about that. So I have one of my sets of designs are zipper dresses with the different pieces of the dress zipped together. But there is a version that I did where because the zippers are usually color matched to the piece that they are set into. But I did do a piece where the zipper was in the contrasting color. And there you get this kind of thing where you zip the pieces together and you get the seams, or in this case, the zippers are in a contrasting color compared to the rest of the garment. So it's all black, but all the zippers are in white, which makes this odd. So it resonated again with some of the design things that I was playing with at some point. And then at the end, she says, hers is a lifetime of research into the fold to her. I think that's Kawabuko. Hers is a lifetime of research into the fold produced by the body's bending, its kneeling, its touching, the fold of the texturing of a given piece of fabric, of the pleating so often part of her designs, the fold of the inside out that brings back to the fore in a garment, turning the seam on itself, the fold that resists becoming a seam, the imperceptible fold even of the infinite line. I think she's also talking about the kimono in that context. But one of the questions that came to mind was, obviously that speaks to me as clothing designer, but it also speaks to me as writer. And so the question I had that came out of it is, what is the fold in a written text? What does that mean? And then in terms of response from Aaron, I got, for what the fold does first and foremost is remind us that the body is never one, is never outside the ecology of its environmental architecting. It's near, far, middle ground, never a question of bare ontology. Anyway, it's not exactly a response, but it's something to think about. But the question I find interesting is, what is a fold in a text? And Deleuze has stuff to say about that. But again, I don't quite know how to translate what Deleuze says into something that I could use in writing. So I'll stop there, but it's just, so it's not a full introduction, but more my own reflections on the chapter.
Jeffrey, am I on mute? No, you can hear me.
Yeah.
Before you started to speak, actually, that was going to be one of my questions to you, was about your designs, and I remember them, in particular the black and white and the zippers and the ability to transform them into something else. So my question to you, and it's interesting, these two quotes at the beginning from the interviews, my intention is not to make clothes. That was from Kawakubo. And the other was, some shapes hold things apart. And when I think about your clothes and the designs, that's an interesting question. Was your intention ever to make clothes as a designer? And I'll go further. And I don't think you weren't reading this before you designed. I don't think you were. Were you? I don't think you were engaged with Manning at all before you started to design these clothes. So, from my perspective, what I find really interesting when I read chapters, and they are very Deleuzian in the sense that this, you know, similar ideas and concepts and imaginings come forward based on how she's writing about it, but they repeat and they're phrased in a different way, and then it makes you think about things in a different way. So when I think about things choreographically and I read Manny simultaneously, it brings out different elements choreographically and about movement that I've never thought about. Is the same thing happening to you when you read this and you've already designed these clothes? What does the writing do to you in terms of a designer? Like, does it affirm certain things that maybe you didn't think about before? Does it challenge you in a different way? Does it sort of lead you to think about designing, whether, and not just with clothing, but in your research and in your writing, does it cause you to think about things in a slightly different way? Like, what's your experience of reading this after you've already designed something?
I was sort of trying to answer that without knowing it was a question, but so I mean, it does make me want to bring my sewing machine back downstairs and get started.
Yes, definitely,
one of the responses to reading this. And you asked a good question. What did I ever want to make clothes? I mean, yes, on the surface I did. Although I didn't want to make them, I wanted to manufacture them.
And what's the difference? What do you mean by that?
I wanted to manufacture a line of clothing that would actually get worn by a certain number of people. It didn't happen that way, but it did and it didn't, right? Some of my clothes are worn by, about 20 to 25 people. So I guess that counts, but it's not hundreds, you know, or thousands. I think it comes back to what we were just talking about for the gay bar, in a sense, because I have a strong female part of myself, in a sense, I designed the clothes I would like to wear as a female. I mean, because I designed for women, but I designed clothes that I would be excited to wear. Hmm. And so if they're not really, you know, I'm not going to wear them because I'm not built that way, but physically, although maybe the corsets, anyway, we'll see. But anyway, I'm not sure how that answers, but I certainly feel this. So that I read that section about constraints. I certainly feel the way the garments constrain movement or constrain the way we feel about ourselves when we're in, or influence the way we feel about ourselves when we wear things. And so that's certainly part of my practice as a designer, is to change some of those things. So the whole idea of transformable garments is the idea of being able to change the way you feel about yourself over the course of the day by modifying your garment on the fly so that it becomes something else and then becomes something else again, so that you change the way you experience your own relation to the world. So that's certainly part of my design ethic, if you like. Anyway, go ahead, John.
Can I ask you a question, a follow-up to that?
Yeah.
I'm sort of riffing on your question and your response. And I don't know if this is useful or not, but it just was coming up to me. Is there a relationship between the design and the skirt you wore when you went to dance in a gay bar? Is there a relationship between all of that and the text or a text? You mentioned earlier the folds in a text.
Yeah, there is.
is there anything else about that?
I'm not sure I can articulate it, though. I mean, you know, my 15 books are all from the same perspective in a kind of way, you know, so, yeah, so.
Is there anything else about that, the 15 books, and the design in the same way?
I mean, what I said is, you know, I have this female side of myself, and so it goes into my design practice. Well, that's, you know, so I made a universe in my books which has seven genders. Why did I do that? Because I'm not unhappy with the gender that I have, but I think the gender possibilities of what it is to be human are far broader than the ones we allow ourselves within our very polarized culture to take on. And so I wanted to write in a context where the gender possibilities are much, much broader. And so that went into the book. So, you know, there are lots of different ways where the two come in, right?
Seven genders? That's a surplus, isn't it?
there are four genitalia. So there are four kinds of genitalia. They're the two basic. They can do new ones. And they come together in different ways. And the genders are called by the octave of music. So they're do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti are the genders.
That's fascinating.
I will put up some of my clothing designs on the site so that you can, so that those who don't know what I do can see a little bit what my...
Please do. And any other questions that might come up?
I don't know if I answered your question, Cora, but hang on, you need to turn it off.
I just wanted to hear you talk about it.
I want to see a video of you performing in that skirt. That's what I want to see.
I don't think I have the skirt anymore. It was a wraparound skirt that I picked up as a young man, and I did wear in public a few times, but that was a challenge. That was definitely a challenge. I'll have to design one that I could wear now.
Okay, so Jeffrey, where's the minor gesture in your design?
Well, it's the zippers, I guess. I mean, one of the things I was interested when I designed both the corsets and the dresses, they're all the transformations are based on zippers. And one of the things that became very clear to me is that zipper is a technology. It is a technology. It wasn't always there. It was developed at a certain point. It's what we today call low tech, but it's underused as a design element in garments. It can be used in so many more ways than it is typically used. And so that was part of the work that I was doing, was to try to broaden the kind of range in which zippers are used in ways that are interesting to modify garments. So that's certainly, I think, a minor gesture in the sense that it destabilizes one's understanding of what a garment is and what it does, and also the relationship, because garments that zip together are also more reusable than typical garments are. So it speaks to the issues of sustainable development and things like that as well. So, we need to move on. It can't be all about me.
It's a trans-individual thing, you know? It's about each of us as individuals, but there's always something more that we're all pointing to, or pointing, it's either up or down or back there, that sort of what's underneath all of this that I think we all are intuiting and riding upon.
Yeah, I'm squirming in my chair, you see.
Well, when I read this chapter, I was asked or felt compelled to think backwards, especially looking at the meaning, the original meaning, the etymology of the word habit, which was its archaic meaning meant clothes. And of course, nuns wear habits, but the word habit means also bearing and conduct and behavior. And Bourdieu uses the word habitus in a really, really interesting way. So I was, I guess, intellectual in this and cognitive. I was thinking about the moving of the words and how her title, whether the title is accurate when she talks about dress becomes body. I wondered if the title might be more accurate or more reflective of her ideas, which she said that dress extends body. It kind of opens body. But of course, some garments things apart and some brings them together again. And that led me to think about Vesalius de Fabricans. And I learned this from my colleague, Elizabeth Harvey, when we did a course about the body many years ago. But the body is seen, especially in the old anatomy drawings, as folds hanging so that the skin is seen as tissue. And the word tissue is also fascinating to me because it's meant in medical terms, it's used quite differently, but in ways they are resonant with each other. The idea of tissue, the idea of fabric, the idea of defabricans, and the idea of habitus. That's where my head has been since I read this chapter. I thought it was very, very, very interesting. And I just to bring this back to today or yesterday, Kate Spade's death by suicide, I thought was fascinating that she was a woman who designed clothes that she imagined and people think were happy and joyful. And at age 56 or 55, whatever she is, she killed herself, hung herself, which I think is interesting in terms of the body hanging and the fabricants. So that's kind of where my head is these days. I don't know if it connects to anyone else's, but the idea of pushing the habit to its limit, and that life cleaves the environment. I like the word cleave, and I'm thinking of Merleau-Ponty and that X, that I think it's called a chiasm. It's all about conceptualizing research, conceptualizing writing, conceptualizing art. I think Aaron takes us, these were all minor gestures to me that cleaved my thinking into new ways. But I have to go soon because I have to be grandma to a beautiful year-old baby whose skin is magnificent. It fits her so well.
I just appreciated, Pat, your mentioning, making the connection between habit and habitus and Bourdieu. I don't know very well, but I'm really fascinated by the topic of cultural fields, yeah, and the fields within fields within fields reminds me of the folds within the folds within the folds.
Exactly.
And what you were talking about, I resonated with, so I'll remember that when I reread this chapter. Thank you.
Also, a really quick comment. When I read that about habit, I was reminded of what she said about ritual and rituality, and I think there's an echo between, I mean, she means something very different by habit from ritual, but there's a connection.
Absolutely.
That has to do with variation. So just as variation comes into ritual, variation comes into habit. And I found the link between the two intriguing.
Well, if you look at the differences between different orders of nuns, what their habits are like, And then further, if you look at the difference between what male clergy, especially in the Roman Catholic Church, and their use of fabric and their covering of skin, and the use of color is so interesting to compare. I'm not quite sure why, but why it's interesting to me, but it really is.
I know Elizabeth Ross talked about habit as well, and linking that to Deleuze and the notion of the refrain in leaving home on the thread of a tune as well, to particular habits as well too. That's when I hear you speak, Pat, that takes me back to that language and those ideas. And it's interesting, when you say the word tissue today, it sounds different to me. I have this picture of a tissue, of how thin and fragile and delicate a piece of tissue is. And when you compare that to skin as well too, like, so you can think about skin in so many different ways as being this sort of border, or this tough exterior that really, you know, can separate the kind of binary, separate one thing from another. But if a tissue is permeable and delicate and fragile, some of these ideas are very fragile as well too. And but it was just interesting that you brought that word up today. When I heard you say it, I had a completely different image in my mind. So thank you for that.
I would recommend just one more thing. The current issue of body and society is all about skin, human skin. It's a magnificent journal. So have a look.
I will, absolutely.
Yeah. I don't have anything that captures the vision of the chapter, but I really love procedural architecture. I have read from Christopher Alexander's Nature of Order, more than a pattern language, which I'm just a little bit familiar with, but the Nature of Order asks, if you have two things, which has more life to it? And he did a lot of research where he asked students to choose, or other people to choose, of these two objects, which one has more life? And from that, then he distilled what gives an object more life. And he came up with his pattern language, or his 15 principles of order. And the an object with more life does certain things, like it works with the environment, which was very much like what procedural architecture sounds like. Beyond the built environment, it is a world-constituting procedure. It builds more than buildings. Its mandate to directly cleave the biosphere, all these things have come up already, to bios cleave, never stops cleaving. So, and then she goes on to say, what cites life, consistent reminder that what cites life also cleaves the environment, opening it to its differential. So there's a lot of echoes. There are a lot of echoes there for me of Christopher Alexander's architecture with more life and how it works with the environment. That's all, just a small note.
I'm just thinking, just riffing on that comment about Alexander and architecture. And I seem to remember reading him, and he's talking about analogy and metaphor as well, and the arrangement of rooms and how close the room is to the outside. If it's close, adjacent to a garden or a walkway or whatever, those kinds of the spaces in between spaces, you know, where the cupboards are, and, you know, where the hallways are. That I think is fascinating and sort of analogous to a previous question that was posed by, I don't know who was talking about this, about the fold in a written text. But I think...
That was me, yeah.
Oh, was that you? Someone was, I just jotted it down. But the fold in the written text for me, I don't think this is too original either, but it's sort of like commas. It's punctuation. It's commas, it's periods, it's semicolons, it's dashes, it's ellipses, the period, and, you know, of course, the paragraph is a various kinds of chunks. You can chunk chunk information in many different ways. But I think there's something, you know, we've all had that experience of writing a sentence and with lots of clauses and there's lots of commas. And then you realize, well, you know, it may be more interesting to just put a period somewhere and take one of those clauses and start a new sentence. But I think that's the kind of, there's a space in between where you're figuring out the punctuation, which I think that's where the folds are, where there's all kinds of different ways you can go about this. That's a bifurcation point. But I think, but the interesting thing is if you make a change, you finish something and you look at it and you say, that sentence, I can clean that up a little bit or redefine it in a way. But if you do that, you have to change the paragraph. And you have to change the other paragraphs and you have to change the whole damn thing because it's intimately connected. So I think these flow states we have when we're writing have lots of these little gaps. And I think punctuation for me, when I read a writer, I think they're really good. I'll study their punctuation because I think that's where all the drama is actually. It's not so much what they say, it's how they say it or how they punctuate something. So thank you for that.
I love that, John. Yeah, I love that. And that would make the chapters the scene.
Exactly.
And we also, when we include punctuation, we tell people where to breathe if they're reading out loud, or what's the interior, you know, correlation to the breath at the punctuation point. So when you're reading to yourself, what do you do at that point instead of taking a breath?
That's a fascinating point you're making, Heather, because as we read poets and then as we listen to the poet recite their poetry or read it out loud, you'll realize they often ignore the punctuation. And they rather than obey the rules about pausing or whatever at the end of a line, they sometimes just keep in jamming it, you know, in their verbal performance and their outward performance. But I think when we read internally, I think we, it's hard to figure it out sometimes. Then you read it out loud and then you read it internally again. I think this going back and forth from internal to speech, to the oral performance, and then returning to an inner speech is, I think that's another fold, which is very interesting because I think that poetry is an oral performance, but it's actually meant to be read silently as well. So it's fascinating to listen to different performances too, as you were doing for us earlier when I think you read Marco's poem. You gave us a recording of Marco's poem. So we have Marco, who is the author of a poem, and we have your version of it as well. And I think that brings out all kinds of nuances that I didn't notice in the text itself.
And I'm reminded while I'm listening to you, I'm reminded that, so Cora's question about my design for clothes, what the minor gesture is. And when I think about it, so my clothes are transformable. That's the sort of basic principle. When I think about my 15 books, they're meant to be read in any order. So there really are the same transformable principle applied to writing that I have in the clothes. So you zip together the different books in any order in order to make the global garment that you walk away with, which doesn't have to be the 15 books. It could be any subset.
Yeah, I think the rhythm of the writing is, I appreciate, Heather, the notion of breath in that as well, and how Deleuze used that in a different way. In reading Deleuze, sometimes I feel like the breath is in the wrong place, and I'm halted in certain ways when I want it to continue rhythmically, but that's his whole point. Is that he wants to disrupt what we might consider an organic flow. Whereas I think with Manning, and that's where I feel the dance in her writing as well too, that there is this, but the use of dashes as well, and the rhythmical nature of her writing also speaks on its own completely, without the words, just the flow and the feel and the rhythm of that writing. And it's meant for a different purpose, I think, than Deleuze, but it's a similar kind of strategy. It's very interesting.
Well, it sounds like we're coming to an end of something. We could give it another go and for 10 minutes, but I did ask Cora if she would do the introduction for chapter 5, which is choreography. I'm wondering, John, if you'd feel comfortable with doing chapter 6, which is about feeling. I think it's a good subject for you.
Great.
I'm up for that. And I will also post Foresight's choreographic objects, if I can still find it. I'm sure it's still there, but it links many of these ideas together, but from a visual point of view as well. So
yeah, I agree. It would be very useful, I think.
Okay.
Any other last thoughts for today's session?
I really enjoyed it. Thank you all. Very stimulating.
My apologies for joining late, and I didn't want to interrupt the flow of that conversation as well. But
it was a good moment.
You should definitely listen to the recording for the early part, because it was very interesting.
I'll do that.
Thank you for participating in the activities, which helped maybe get us into the experience of the chapter 3.
Yeah, it was a wonderful way to introduce the text, I thought. Okay.
All right.
Next time. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Doug.